in a little bit. Are you there?
No.
Oh,
yes.
There you are.
Yeah.
I'm here.
I'm here too.
Can we get a level check? Tom, one. Tom, Tom, one.
Tom, Tom, two. Tom, Tom, two.
Kick. Kick. Kick.
Kicky. Kicky. I can't be exactly the same, but mostly the same. So if you say Tom, Tom, one, you know, that sounds fun.
Yeah.
So I said Tom, two.
It does,
but
it works.
To be different, mm-hmm. but also to also get the pleasure of doing what you did.
This is Stack Direct 1.
And this is Stack Direct 2. Is it Stack
this
Direct 2?
This is bass pedal. Bass pedal.
Remember
what the sound guys do, like when they set up on stage? You ever,
oh, yeah.
You ever like in a theater or an arena when they're putting it and they do that?
Sibilance.
And they're testing for...
I have, but I haven't paid attention to the level that you have where you have accumulated a whole, like, language.
Well,
like, you know all
like,
the things.
I would have to, like, MC these shows for radio stations. And you would go in, and you'd let you go in, and you'd hear them doing all that before they let the audience in, and like you know they would always look at you suspiciously, like who's this guy? It's like you know the guy from the local radio station, and he's sitting waiting to talk to whoever he's got to. Usually, you're talking to like the promoter, or you're talking to usually it was like somebody in the venue wherever you were, and they wanted you. They could care less about who was coming up on stage. Like that, they didn't even know. All they wanted you to do was talk about how the fact that like the bar was over there. You can get T-shirts over here. The promoter wanted you to like talk about the T-shirt table. The guy that owned the place wanted you to talk about the bar because that's where they made all their money. You know what I mean? Like they wanted you.
So what would they do? Would they prompt you? Like, could they? Would they say, "Hey, can you make
you
sure
just
you
nod,
talk about
like,
this?"
Like, oh yeah, yeah, I've got it all. Are you gonna write down? No, I got it all. Because all you were going to do was walk up on stage. Okay, the band didn't really want to be introduced by some local Yahoo at the radio station. They just wanted to walk out, and you just wanted to like maybe go and meet the band or something, and then either watch a couple of songs, have a beer, or go home. Usually, like at some point, I just wanted to introduce the band and go home. Because I really didn't, I'd been working all day. So you would just walk up and go, "Ladies and gentlemen, XYZ." And that would be it. You would go, "I'm so-and-so." And you just want to get out.
Right.
Like you was just, you know.
Well, because.
You collect your fee and you leave.
Right. Would you?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So that wasn't like the radio station sponsoring things?
It was
kind of like.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And there were times in my life that I would get this, you'd get a talent fee for showing up. And then there were other times where you were helping out the station.
I wish I got a talent fee.
You know.
Just one time, even like $15.
Just be, well, as validation that you had talent?
Yeah, because if you're getting a talent fee, right?
Yeah.
You're getting paid for talent.
The best part about it was that when I was an underage disc jockey.
Oh,
yes. And you'd get to go into these places and still drink because they would just assume. Like always with the radio station, you must be old enough.
You mean you were a DJ
and you'd get the free
when
drinks.
You were like 19, 20?
Yeah.
When did you start?
I was 18, my first commercial job, or was it 19? I think I might have just turned 19. Yeah, I think it was just after I turned 19 that I got my first like commercial radio thing.
That's pretty amazing.
It was good because you could, and it was like they would just throw stuff at you, freebie stuff. So you would go and do these clubs or, you know, and then you could just drink and act like an idiot. It didn't matter because the band was always acting like idiots.
Right.
So by comparison, you always look like the lesser idiot. Does that make sense?
It does.
Yeah.
I'm amazed, though, that it seems like, maybe it's not, but it seems like that would almost be impossible these days to get a DJ. I mean, there aren't that many DJ jobs left.
Yeah, there's just not that many places that you can go. That just, you know, I think the disc jockey is just kind of dying out, especially in you know rock radio. Now, rock radio is dying out. There's just not that. It's like you know.
I listened to The Planet the other day as I was driving.
Did you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you ever listen and think about it?
Yeah, I do. Because you know it's one of those few stations in our area that still plays new music.
Right. Yeah, and it was I didn't know what the song was, and I liked it, so I was like,
yeah,
"Hey, it's still alive."
You know, the few rock stations that are left, they're still banging out Led Zeppelin and The Who and all that stuff. But to have a station that plays new music, like real new bands,
yeah,
is really interesting.
I never know why they don't go against the current grain of you know formatting. you know, like all these stations seem to know they're following the Jeff format or the top. Well, they all have these little systems, these built-in things, and they know, and they all sound the same.
It's all so insidious. I mean, and radio's always been that way since the top 40 format was originated, like in the late 50s or whenever it was. It's this kind of, well, it was successful in one city, and then it suddenly will mushroom up and balloon because, well, it worked there. We'll just copy that and use that here.
Right.
And that's what the whole music radio system has been built on over the years, and it's all just dying off now. It just doesn't matter in the age of the internet. It just doesn't.
That's
just
what
doesn't
it seems like. There should be some exciting, like, okay, we're going down. How can we hold on?
And some do, I think. I think there are examples here and there. Hmm. There are examples. I don't think there are many of them, but you know, it's hard. It's really hard to make money in radio in a lot of places. You know, since the late 1950s, the model has been essentially the same. The format's different, but it's essentially the same. You find X number of songs that work for a particular demographic, and you play that, and then around that, you find talent that kind of lives that lifestyle, that kind of plays it up a little bit, that can enhance that music presentation.
All right.
You know, that's the morning zoo formats where you get a bunch of people on in the morning. That was all kind of to play to that demographic.
Right.
The music was part of it.
Right.
And it was, you know, it was almost like a lifestyle channel, really.
Right.
And that's what it's been essentially for 45, 50 years now.
Right. Well, that's why it seems like it's almost purely, I guess, an advertisement. It's almost a constant advertisement where they're selling to you an image of some sort that you want to be associated with,
exactly.
Whether you want to be young and fresh and hot, or whether you want to be in the clubs, or whether you want to be the cool guy on the street, you know, doing that thing. I don't know if kids still do that, where they steer, but they lean into the middle. Have you seen that?
you know where you see that a lot is pickup trucks. Have you noticed
pickup truck guys do that?
I see guys in pickup trucks. They're always like, they got their arm around their girlfriend. They pull her close in the middle of the truck. It's like this possessive thing almost, and they're driving the truck. Yeah, I don't know why I've seen that a lot.
Well,
maybe
it's because
of where I live, but...
Is it rough? I mean, I think I thought it was an inner city kind of, a projects kid doesn't want to get hit in a drive-by. So they, so he's in the middle.
You can't even see those guys. Like
they're always low in the middle. Yeah,
they're like in hatchbacks. Like the seat is so far back. And they're leaning so far back. I don't know how any of those guys steer.
Oh, they have it down. I mean,
their arm has got to be all the way.
They have extension rods.
Yeah.
That they attach to the wheel.
They're barely. They look like they're like little old women because all you see is a little bit. They see the eyebrow hanging out the windshield because they're so. Their seat is so laid back. Is so far back.
But once you start though, you can't stop though. I mean.
I guess it's. I don't know. It's
one of those things though. It's a bit like a version of the pants down with the boxer shorts showing.
Mm-hmm.
Those people that have the pants down. It's that kid gets in his car and then he leans. It's a fashion thing, but it's also and it's one of those fashion things where the people who aren't doing it are just like, you have to stop that. Young man, would you please pull your pants up and sit in your seat straight?
What is that? Who does that? Why would you do that?
It is irritating. That is the most.
You're
I think
being
the,
silly.
The pants down thing is drives me. But I think you know what it is that I want to. I need a reason. I need to fathom it in some way. So mm-hmm. if they could come and say the reason that we're doing this with the pants, the reason that I'm leaning into the middle here, no, and low, going low,
but see, you,
low that, and slow.
There's no reasoning involved.
Well, they, no could, they if, you know, if just, they just said, "I think it looks good,"
yeah,
I'll be like, "Okay." If you think it looks good, I can't.
See, if
fight
you have
it.
To ask for a reason, you're old. You know what I mean?
I will admit that.
Yeah.
I'll be like, listen, I'm old. What is the reason? And then the kid says, it looks good. And
I've
I'm
never
like,
thought,
fine.
I mean, you were talking about 16-year-old kids. Reasoning doesn't come into it. There's no rhyme or reason to anything a 16-year-old does.
Well, I don't know. I think there is, but they won't tell you. And what I want to do is I want to get to the bottom of it.
They probably can't process the full reasoning. They probably couldn't put together the coherent sentence to give you the reason.
I think they need to be introduced to the concept of vanity and mm-hmm. how valuable and important it is to them at that time in their life so that they can just keep referencing it. Just keep going, I'm just being vain. I have to be. It's very important.
Mm-hmm.
I need to look at myself in the mirror a lot, think about myself, craft my identity, follow certain things, imitate this or that, just to find out who I am.
Yeah, maybe. I'm not sure that you could get a 16-year-old, an average 16-year-old, to put it that way, too. Mm. I think they would just give you a blank stare. I think it would be Homer Simpson, one eyeball going that way, one eyeball going the other way, going, there's no way to answer the question. It's just like...
Don't you feel like Homer Simpson more than you would like?
Yeah.
It's not comfortable. I think because when I was younger, Homer Simpson was kind of like a... He was some different, had nothing to do with me, my generation, who I was. But more and more, I feel like that
he's the universal
guy on the couch.
American dad.
Yeah.
I don't know. What annoys me, though, is that kind of the whole thing right now with TV sitcoms and that whole kind of dumb father figure guy.
Right.
Like just the clueless father. I just find that, I don't know. It's not as if I want to, you know, run down to the castle with a pitchfork and a torch. I just, all like television commercials, it's always the dumb dad. It's always the clueless dad.
It's the current stereotype model that it's the go-to thing. It makes everybody mm-hmm. laugh. And I think that it's just like what you were saying with radio stations. It's just that whole same, you know, it's
it worked somewhere. That formula worked here.
Yeah.
We can transplant that.
I mean, once they come up with a convincing new father that gets the same amount of laughs, then they'll move to that,
mm-hmm.
you know? It's just like when, you know, during the era of Friends, there were a lot of Matthew Perry guys
mm-hmm.
around doing Matthew Perry. And, you know, and it makes sense. It's just that's how we are as a culture, and that's how we are as people. We love to imitate, to discover things because it's fun. I mean, our nature is sort of playful, and we kind of forget that. We play with these things all the time.
It's true. That's a good point. I remember at the time that Seinfeld and Friends were, you know, really big. I remember people in my little group of who would be like the George.
Yeah, yeah.
Really? Well, you're kind of more like the George. No, I think you're more like the Kramer. Or I think, oh, no, everybody had an Elaine in their group. You know, right. There was always that kind of thing where you would kind of identify with your favorite character somehow.
Or you would just, if you were in conversation with a friend, they would say something, then you would say something, and it would be very Jerry-ish mm-hmm. or George-ish, or you know, you'd burst into a room a little bit too...
Kramerishly.
But you would, you could be aware of it, you know, mm-hmm. and it was kind of fun to even, to riff on... The things that you're enjoying at the same time.
And I saw some Seinfeld because it runs endlessly on 10 channels. There was a Seinfeld episode, and I decided to watch it for a while. And it occurred to me for the first time, and this was maybe a week or two ago, that it looks aged for the first time to me.
Yeah.
It didn't look aged to me for many years, but now it looks of its time. Maybe it was because Jerry had this enormous cordless phone.
Yeah, right, with the big long
the big long antenna. Yeah, and so it was obviously a pretty early one, but it suddenly looked, and I remember thinking how amazing it was and how almost revolutionary that show seemed at the time. Mm-hmm. And I think at the time I probably was in my first apartment when this show was started to get really big. This might have been like 1990 or something. I don't know. And I remember how yeah. really cool it was to watch that show and have my little group of friends. And it was very Seinfeldish in a way. And now when I watch it, I think for the, oh, wow, it really does look of its time. It really does look a little
Well, it looks a little grainy, too. Like yeah. The film quality is degraded.
Well, but, everything's all HD now, too. Right. So I think maybe that has something to do with it, but.
But I remember when that show ended, the finale, I thought to myself, and I think I talked with Lois about it, and I thought, this is one of those shows that isn't going to date. Like, mm-hmm. people will be, like, it's going to be like Lucy. Mm-hmm. One of those shows that 50 years from now people can watch. It just felt that way to me. But then I recently sort of took a look at it, and it did feel, not even just the way that it looked, that it's kind of, as compared to the HD stuff, but the feeling of it,
yeah.
it felt of its time more than I thought it would be. I thought it was going to be more universal, but there was something about it that was kind of 90s based.
Right.
It was more Friends-like than I thought. Like, I thought Friends, that's a show 20 years from now is going to be irritating.
Much more throwaway. Yeah. I always thought of Seinfeld, and I never was a fan of Friends. I always thought Seinfeld was a much better show.
Yeah.
Much better written, more interesting, a little more, you know, a little more subversive. Well, it was. And I still think it's a good show. I still think it holds up.
Right.
But it does seem of its time. It does feel like...
Well, when we were watching that show, it was amazing. I mean, mm-hmm. it was the part of this magical Thursday lineup of three or four shows. I can't remember them. Maybe one of them was Friends. But people thought of it as a classic in the making. Mm-hmm. You know, you knew it was sort of like this once-in-a-lifetime program. You know, this is a special show. You have to watch it, and you knew that it had historical value while you were watching it. And
I remember thinking with the night that the first time I saw the episode about Master of Your Domain, and they got through an entire half hour talking about a show about masturbation and never mentioned the word once.
Oh yeah,
there was always that euphemism, and I thought. Brilliant. I thought it was the most brilliantly written 30 minutes in television. I thought, this is going to be like, this is up there with, you know, All in the Family or MASH or, you know, any of those, you know, classic TV shows that we think
Good
of.
Morning!
Yeah, good morning.
Nothing like some good, solid sack time.
She's not there. She's doing a wash.
Oh, so, did you make it through the night?
Yes, I'm proud to say I did.
So you're still master of your domain?
Yes. Yes, I am. Master of my domain. But I will tell you this. I am going over to her apartment, and I'm telling her to put those shades down.
Wait, what did you just say?
I can't take it anymore. She's driving me crazy. I can't sleep. I can't leave the house. I'm here. I'm climbing the walls. Meanwhile, I'm dating a virgin. I'm in this contest. Something's got to give.
Do you hear what you're saying? Can you hear it? This is a beautiful woman walking around naked, and you want to tell her to stop? That's the dumbest thing I ever heard. I mean, it's incomprehensible. I'm not going to let you do it.
Well, I'm doing it.
Get out of my way. You can't. This is something that comes about once in a lifetime. When we were boys looking through our bedroom windows, we would think, why can't there be a woman out there taking her clothes off? And now that wish has come true, and you want to throw it away?
Look, I'm sorry.
No, I'm not going to let you do it, Jim.
Kramer, get out of my way.
Don't do it. For my sake.
God knows I don't ask you for much.
Now, come on. Please, Jerry. I'm begging you. Please. Come on. Please.
Oh, yes.
Thank you.
She's not there.
Oh, I can wait.
I got into the show, I was down in Alabama. I was in Alabama at the time. And,
what were you doing in Alabama?
I had been walking across the country. And, I ran out of money. And so I went down and I stayed with my friend Harry, a college, roommate of mine.
Were you walking from Atlanta? I knew you lived in Atlanta.
Oh, from
right?
Boston.
Oh, you went from Boston?
Yeah.
You walked down to Alabama from Boston?
No, I walked into Ohio.
You walked from Boston to Ohio?
Yeah.
I drove that once and got tired.
Yeah.
I can imagine what it's like.
Yeah, it was, I didn't have very much money to begin with, and I got really lonely which it's weird because I've always been a very alone person. So for me, thinking about, you know, going to the Arctic or going somewhere like Appalachian Trail or something like that, I don't worry about the loneliness part, but then I go out there and do it. I get really lonely. I mean, I walked on the Appalachian Trail for 6 or 8 weeks also.
And but you come into contact with lots of people.
You do. There are lots of people.
I talked about that in another episode, and we were talking about the fact that you kind of come in and out of, of groups of people.
But you still get lonely. I mean, it's sort of like there's nothing permanent in those friendships on the Appalachian Trail. I mean, it could be, but that actually might even create the loneliness, is that you form these friendships pretty close over a few hours, a day or two, and then they disappear. It's very sad, and you're like, am I ever going to see the Silver Eagle again? You know, what about the trail wizard? Where is he? Has he left the trail? I don't even know where he lives. So you see these people, and you kind of had this weird, you know, you're like army buddies almost feeling because you're doing this weird, difficult thing.
My kid's going to camp for a week, and then it's you never see them again kind of thing.
So anyway, I went to Alabama, just lack of money, and crash out there and see what he's doing, Harry, and just see what Alabama's all about. Not that I'd ever been curious about Alabama, but, you know, he invited me to come down, so I hopped on a bus. And he had this friend, a kid, I don't remember the guy's name, but this was probably three episodes into Seinfeld, when, and Seinfeld wasn't doing very well
right,
at the beginning.
Yeah. Was it called The Chronicles or something like that, or Seinfeld Chronicles, I think?
It may have been called The Seinfeld Show. Yeah. Or I don't remember. They did change it to Seinfeld.
Yeah, I remember it was just, I had just left college and it was starting up. And I remember it was pretty early on. I remember it was like a stand-up kind of thing at first. And it just seemed like kind of cheesy. And
they mixed it. Know. They mixed the, I think they changed the mixture of how much stand-up there was to how much show there was.
Yeah.
In the first episodes, I think it was more like Jerry and Elaine, like, had just broken up or were breaking up or were coming together. It was more about their relationship, and it had a slightly strange feel, but it was still, you know, the basic sensibilities were there already, but people didn't quite warm to it. Like it did almost, I think, get canceled around the sixth, seventh episode. There was some struggling, but I remember there was this guy who three episodes in was an absolute fanatic about Seinfeld.
This is your friend?
No, it was a friend of his, a guy I didn't know at the time. And this fanatic made us go over to his house, where he made us watch the first three episodes that he'd recorded on his VCR. And I didn't even actually notice. I was like, well, I don't know why he's so crazy about this show. And so, I mean, I like it. It's okay. But he somehow knew that this was this super special show, kind of like Kurt Russell in that Disney movie who he had a monkey, and the monkey would clap whenever there was going to be a hit movie, so he became like did you ever see that?
No. Sounds crazy to me.
Kurt Russell did all these Disney movies. Yeah. He had this whole, you remember Kurt Russell in the Disney World? That he just had like like the strongest man in the world. That might have been Jan Michael Vincent.
I think he was collecting paychecks quickly for those. Yeah,
he was perfect.
Yeah,
he was just charming and hapless and a little bit like the fifth monkey. You know, kind of like slightly longish hair. Mm-hmm. You know, but
isn't it interesting to me? Isn't it interesting to you?
It is interesting.
Is it interesting to you as it is to me that there are revolutionary or seemingly revolutionary things that happen in film or television or music or whatever, and at the time, they're very modest or even almost they're almost flops.
Yeah,
you know, you could take things like I remember, you know, hearing this story about, you know, Dark Side of the Moon. You know, Pink Floyd had been kind of this moderate kind of psychedelic band, and they put out Dark Side of the Moon, and you know, it was kind of like, you know, I don't think it's another kind of, you know, space out album. And then all of a sudden, as slowly over the course of a year or two, it started to get a little bigger and bigger and bigger. And then, of course, it had this monstrous hit with it. But
it is weird that we don't notice these things.
There's cult movies that nobody paid attention to, nobody cared about, that nowadays are considered these all-time classics. There's, you know, it's interesting.
Well, it's a Wonderful Life is one of those, you know, that came out, didn't do that well.
Yeah. Great Gatsby.
Yeah.
It's considered the great American novel.
Yeah.
People thought, nah, he's lost it. You know, it's not his, you know, what was his first? It's no
F. Scott Fitzgerald.
Yeah, it's not. It's, you know, Great Gatsby didn't sell all that well.
Right.
And he actually was making a lot more money from doing serial episodes and magazines.
Well, I think you'd sort of, like with I feel like I would be the guy who would read The Great Gatsby without anyone saying anything. I would go, this is a great book. This is going to stand the test. But I wouldn't. I would be just like everybody else.
I would be too. I feel the same way.
And it's like the Seinfeld thing. I didn't notice how great it was.
I probably wouldn't have for a while either.
I'm discouraged.
And it's funny because every couple of, why do I keep saying that? What a crutch I have.
What is it?
Isn't it funny? Isn't it interesting? I say those two things constantly.
All right, we got to do an intervention.
I need to, somebody has got, you've got to point this out. If there's anybody that listens to these things over and over.
Count them.
You know, I want you to, you could do a drinking game. Every time Ganley says, isn't it interesting?
That counts too.
Or it's funny. I'm going to have you guys sauced up in 20 minutes.
Right. Well, it could be a drinking. Well, then why would you deny them the pleasure? You know, I think
I always hated drinking games because I didn't need an excuse.
Let me tell you this, though. If that's your crutch, I never noticed it.
Oh. Okay.
So if you're walking around with crutches, it looks like you're a regular guy with two functional legs. Not in casts, nothing under your arms.
Just like Roosevelt, baby. It's all smoke and mirrors. But, you know, I think...
Isn't it funny?
I'm avoiding the crutch. Every 2 or 3 years, I think, I want to read more F. Scott Fitzgerald. And I grab The Gatsby because it's such a short book. You can read it, you know, in an afternoon. And I reread it. And it's one of those things that, for me, one of the very few things in any kind of media that I've gone back to that I think gets better with time. I think it is a fantastically well-written book.
It is
such a good book, such a good story. I think it's fairly timeless, and it's so American in its storytelling, and it's so good. I don't know how many things I can say that about over and over again.
Right.
Some of the movies I've loved 25, 30 years ago, when I see them again, it was good, but there's parts of it I can see were really weak. You know, certain albums that I still go back to occasionally. Very few are the Dark Side of the Moons of the world. Very few are the Great Gatsbys of the world.
Yeah.
There's so few that you can take repeatedly that you go, just every inch of this, every word, it's just perfect.
Well, there's something, I think there are plenty of things that can be considered equal works of art that don't bear repeating. You know, how many times are you going to be able to read Moby Dick and dig it? You know, but the thing about Dark Side of the Moon and the thing about the Gatsby is there is a particular silky beauty in both of them that is almost like a flavor.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't necessarily, and it's special to those things and it's special to other things, but it allows for this kind of constant, you could keep dipping back into it and you are not going to get tired of it. But I don't know if that defines, like, does that make them... Maybe it does. Maybe that thing is like, it's like this extra bit of elixir that makes those two things stand up like a little bit higher, maybe, you know, than Moby Dick or something else.
But is it also, I am a product of the hype? I'm a product of that overhyping because I've been told all my life, you've got to listen to this is the greatest thing ever. This book, best thing ever.
You know, I think the first time you read it, maybe you go, you know what, I really loved Old Man and the Sea, because you know that you're expected to. But after a while, especially if you listen to a particular album many, many times, you're standing on your own feet with it. You know, your relationship to it is pure and separate from any kind of cultural conformity.
Especially as you grow and have more experiences.
Yeah. So, your love of those things is just your love of those things. I don't think it has anything to do with, like, you know, some wonderful critic going,
well, one of the best books that I ever heard of was Great Gatsby.
Which is how cultural book critics always talk, because they don't talk well. They talk Southern and weird.
Of course. Oh, yeah, I know. Idiocy always comes with a Southern accent, you know?
And that's unfortunate.
Isn't that ridiculous that we do that? I'm number one guilty of it. I did that all the time when I was doing morning radio. It was always, you know.
The Southern dummy?
Yeah, the dumb guy. let's listen to some Skinner. You know, I always did that. And when I think about it, it's pretty ignorant and insulting, isn't it?
One thing I read the other day that I thought was interesting in terms of language, and this is sort of turned my mind around, but that it's possible that American English is more historically valid as the, like, we have maintained the British tongue more than the British have. So the way that we speak now is more British than the way that the British speak. So
the,
like,
modern British tongue?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah. The two things that had to do, they spoke about the rhotic, which is the way that we say R's.
Mm-hmm.
So we say R's with a hard R, like, whereas the current British pronunciation is a soft R. Like, for hard, we say hard. They would say hard, H-A-H-D. We mm-hmm. say H-A-R-D. That's a hard R, which is the way that it was spoken by British, the British people, or the English people, 200 years ago.
Really?
Yeah, but then the aristocracy,
never thought that.
At some particular point, it became fashionable to speak in this different sort of way. They sort of introduced these...
Was it to separate themselves from the middle classes?
It just became cool. Like, so it's like a couple hundred years ago, it became cool to speak a little bit differently, and then it caught on everywhere. So when we think of, like, the English language, we think of, like, the way that the English speak it as sort of backtracking through time.
And you as know, the standard.
Yeah, but in this strange upside-down thing, we actually perhaps, and they don't know this because we don't have any recordings of what people actually sounded
sure.
like back then, but we actually could be more in speaking a kind of true old English than the dummies in London.
There should be some recordings, I would imagine, of 100 and, say, 20 years ago somewhere. But what's interesting to me about that aspect of it is any of those older recordings from the dawn of recorded sound, everyone is so formal that you don't get an idea of what people sounded like in their day-to-day life.
Right.
It's like film from that time. It was all posed. It was all portraits. It was all... It's very few, very little of the kind of everyday...
Right, and even back then in America, it seemed like we are... Like the formal person almost spoke with an English. There was sort of an upper crust accent that I think that Americans maybe adopted. So
it was
if they
crisper.
Were being,
it
yeah.
was much more announced. It was much more of. At least it seems to me.
Yeah.
Because of those, but again, I think that's because of the media of the day. I wonder if you and I, just average guys, would have been speaking that way, say in 1890.
I wonder. I you know, another thing that I wonder about in the old days is how people treated each other. Like, I wonder if you travel back in time, whether you'd be really, really upset by the way people interacted. Like, whether the feeling on the street, like whether your friendships with people, you know, if you could appear 100 years ago, 200 years ago, 300 years ago, and sort of have friendships, have different things, your different experiences, whether suddenly, you know, these were just much more animal-like experiences, much more violent, you know, without real warmth, or whether they were very, very similar, like whether we've always been sort of the same with each other, I guess, and maybe with just terrible kings killing everybody, but different circumstances, but sort of similar arrangements between ourselves.
I think it might be a little more formal with strangers, but I don't think personal relationships would have been any different. I just had that feeling that human nature has stayed the same and consistent.
That's interesting.
You know,
I would sort of hope so.
Friendly people, if you had known each other, I mean, obviously if you meet in the street, I think it might have been a little more formal, I'm guessing, especially between, say, men and women. You know, I'm sure the sexes were a little more formal with each other. But I'm betting that if you traveled back to the same spot here, you know, 150, 200 years ago, and we both knew each other in that life, it would be a friendly,
right?
It would be a friendship. And I bet, you know, I'm just feeling, I feel like human nature
yeah.
essentially stays the same.
It does feel like that when you think about it, when you sort of check in with yourself. But then, you know, there's some weird things that happened a while ago. But, you know, you're mentioning sort of like the formal relationship between men and women.
Mm-hmm.
That just, doesn't it seem like there are much more opportunities to be cool in the old days? Like, because when things are really tight and formal, you know.
There's mystery.
Yeah, and then, but also then you can sort of break that wall, you know? You know, like, so maybe you see the girl and she's, and you can be very formal with her, but then you can kind of like be a little sly and really break down a
and
wall.
Stand out.
Yeah, cause like a real opportunity to be cool, whereas what can you do now? There's nothing. You just, everybody's just a human being standing there. We, all the walls are down. We kind of know what's going on.
That's very true, especially in the internet age where everything is laid out bare for everybody, social media-wise.
Right.
I mean, it takes just moments to get little details about someone you just met.
Right, you can learn and really weird, intimate things about people, what they like.
And everybody dresses casually.
Yeah.
You know, we don't, and we all kind of let it all hang out. We're all very casual with each other, even if we just meet. Even in a business situation.
Right.
I think people are much more casual, obviously, than they would have been just 30, 40 years ago.
I think in the reverse way, I think that's why we like Downton Abbey. You know, I think we love this hierarchical structure where the servants are set off from the people who own the house. And they have a really loving relationship, but it's based on hierarchy. And even the people, I don't know if you watch.
I do watch it.
It's
interesting that you brought it up because I was
you thinking about it.
Yeah, I wouldn't have thought to,
like, Mr. Carson, the main butler guy.
Yeah,
or whatever he's called. That I don't know what the main guy is. Mr. Carson. He loves the family he works for, you know, and he would protect them. He would throw down his life for them.
And he is almost as much of a father figure,
right,
as Lord Grantham, the man of the manor.
Right, the daughters love him.
Because he was there from the beginning with the daughters. Yeah, so he's as much of a, in a strange way, he's as much of their father.
Right,
as their father is. It's yeah, I know what you mean, and I think it's interesting too that you get a glimpse of both of these different worlds, these upstairs downstairs worlds. And how they kind of interact a little bit. And I think our perception was that kind of, you know, the servants were considered lesser than. And I don't think they really saw them necessarily that way. They thought they were being very, they felt they were being very, what do you call it? They were very protective of their servants. You know, they had to provide employment for them. They provided health for them. They provided all kinds of service. They felt like they were, in some ways, part of their family, detached. I mean, obviously not the same, not on the same level, but I think we in the modern age think of it as it was almost servitude, almost.
Right.
But it really wasn't.
Right.
You know, it was indentured servants.
Right. But there was a really great warm agreement between.
Yeah.
I mean, that's sort of how it's presented, whether it was that way or not.
Well, that's true. And I'm sure that there were all kinds of, there's all kinds of gray scale here, you know. You might get a glimpse of one story in one house, but it could have been different in all different places.
But I just wonder why is it that I am warmed by the fact that Mr. Carson loves Lord Grantham. This, and loves that he works for him. That he's in a second tier down from him. Why does that seem like a clear, like a very, to me, like a very clear, obvious, loving relationship?
Because it is clear. And I think that's what you always are kind of searching for. Especially, we tend to think of our modern age as being so open to option and so modern and so, we can do anything we want. But that almost can instill a paralysis in you. Well, what do I do? You're standing in the aisle. You're looking at all that cereal. Well, it's great. I have all this choice, but what do I do?
Right.
That's what modern life feels like. And I think there's a kind of, you know, warmed over, nostalgic feeling for, well, at least there was clear-cut roles. You could get into that role for life. You could have that protection for life, and you knew how to do it, and you could do your job very, very well.
Right.
There's that kind of, it's...
Right,
a certainty.
Yeah, we don't have anything like that. There's no shoes to step into that we know what they look like already.
And if we did, we'd fight like hell to get out of it.
Right,
because that's the way we have been brought up. We have this feeling of, we should be able to, you know, I shouldn't have to be relegated to a class of living.
Right,
and
So yeah. Are you watching it live as it airs, like the season three?
I am. Yeah, okay. I haven't downloaded it. I know that there are people that have. And I
downloaded it.
I did you?
So I saw it 7 or 8 months ago.
Okay, see, I didn't. I thought I might, I'll just wait for it. I like the show and I'm enjoying it, but it, especially the first couple of episodes this season that we got over here in America, I didn't think were very strong until this last one, where I don't think I'm going to destroy anybody's. When Lady Sybil died.
What?
I thought that was a really fantastic episode. I thought that was extremely well done. It was really moving.
It was very powerful.
And I thought it was probably the most powerful one that I've seen of all three seasons. But I can't say that I'm really invested in like the whole Bates storyline. I'm getting sick of Mr. Pius Bates. I hope that he turns out just to be a cold-blooded killer who's just repressed all his angry feelings and then explodes. I'm really hoping for that.
That's interesting because he kind
you
of...
You know, right? Because you...
I'm not going to... Well, I, maybe I do, but I don't know. But he,
see, I'm watching you for signs.
He arrived under a dark cloud, limping away with his brace on his leg.
But with a history of Lord Grantham.
Right. Yeah. Personal history, war buddy, equal footing. And so that was great. And then the whole, his leg gets a little better with Anna. I can't remember her name. Anna's help. Mr. Bates. I love trying to say Mr. Bates' name. Oh my God. There should be a total gay Downton Abbey.
There really should be. It's got so many gay undertones.
Just all men. Just the whole house.
The whole
of
manservant
men.
Thing is just,
Mr. Bates.
Mr. Bates.
But you're right. I think your insight there, Mr. Bates has just a little bit. I mean, he's in such a tough circumstance. He's in jail and all these bad things.
But you know when his prison mate asked him, he goes, "How are you so pious, Bates?"
Right.
I thought, perfect question. How are you so pious?
Right.
Turn around and shank the guy. Take him down. Take him down, Bates.
I can't believe I'm hearing anti-Bates talk because the guy is in jail, wrongly thrown there by his horrible, like, crazy wife who just can't allow him to be happy with Anna.
Which is, it's a ridiculous storyline in itself that this woman would make it her life's work to destroy this guy.
Are you sure it's ridiculous?
I don't know.
Are you positive? Because if you're not, I don't even want you making that point.
Maybe it's because I'm married to a woman. I can't imagine turning on me and wanting to kill me or... Yeah, but I don't.
Suicide by cake, my friend.
I know. Wasn't it a pie?
I baked it myself.
It was a pie.
And you're never gonna find out.
I don't know. I don't know. I don't know.
Well, the thing is you can't. One of the most. The smartest, most acute element of Downton Abbey is how seamless, and how they. Manage to keep you from examining the stories themselves.
They'd be like, very thin plot lines.
Yeah, don't put it down on paper and look at it, because if you do, you're going to be like, has there anybody that has ever done this?
If you read it as a novel, if you read that out, you would just, this is, what is this, 50 Shades of Grey crap? I mean, you throw it out and go, this is soap operatic. There's no meat here.
It's too close to 50 Shades. But I don't even like talking about that. I just am like, let it go.
I agree.
Don't even talk
I
about
still
it.
Like
don't
the
analyze
show.
It.
I still like the show, and I still think it's got something to it.
The characters are great.
Mm-hmm.
They're unique and special, and it's really the atmosphere that these characters have created all together that is the single pull of the show. With a different set of actors, I don't know if it would be there, but they have all created this really delicious air that I just want to, I don't care what they're doing.
Yeah,
I mean, they can make it as ridiculous as they want. And then when they do something, They do silly things like with the cake and Mr. Bates, and you're like, that's just boring me to tears. Let him out of jail, whatever. I guess he's out now, right? Isn't he? Have you seen that? Ooh, shoot.
You're kidding me, really? Why would you do that to me?
Well, I didn't, I was like, I can't remember the time.
I figured that
he's
got to
get out, right?
But you know what the thing is? When they kill off Lady Sybil, why take out the hot one?
It's true.
She's the one, and she was the great free spirit. She was the one that took off with the chauffeur, went to Ireland, and damn it, she was cute. You know why? Can they bring her back in like zombie form? Zombies are hot now. Can we bring her back somehow? Because she'd even be a good looking zombie.
When we watched this and she was dead, I was in shock for that reason. And
I could see it coming through the whole episode. You could see that was going to happen. And I knew it was going to happen. But when it happened, it was done really.
It was very moving.
It was really moving. It was really well done. You know, they have a really good way of doing that. Remember the wedding scene between Daisy and what's his name there? Tall, long dying guy. Took him forever to die. You know,
are you talking about the tall?
Yeah, what was his name? Daisy's, you know, she married him on his deathbed. Daisy, the kitchen maid.
Oh, Daisy. Right. The servant that was kind of meek and mild, who sacrificed himself for
Matthew. He was dying, and on his deathbed, Daisy finally agreed to marry him, even though she really didn't want to.
Oh, wasn't that painful?
But I thought it was a really moving scene. Because they showed the upstairs and downstairs people, they kind of panned across them, and you can see the emotion in all of them for this scene. And it, to me, that was, I think, really... They do pivotal scenes like that.
I think
really well.
I think you're right. That is why I think we also remain with it, is because as goofy as it is on one hand, it will explore these strange kind of dark experiences like Daisy agreeing. I mean, it's sort of like it's a peculiarly complex scenario to think about. You're like, what does this mean? You know, he's dying. She doesn't love him. He loves her. He doesn't know she doesn't love him. They get married. She's torn. It's this weird, torn experience that has some positive side and dark. And then they do this beautiful death scene with Lady Sybil. And then they do these other ridiculous things. So it's like we accept it because they do this solid, deep work here. So we let it go.
Yeah.
But I'm still a little sad that, you know, this anti-Bates thing, because I never, and I feel like, you know what, it's strange because I hadn't thought about it before.
I don't hate him. I'm tired of the plot line and the prison scenes. You know, the blue color, the blue lensing they do with it, the gray blue hue they give it. And it's almost too simplified, and it has to be for time. I understand, but I'm just like solve it, this part so we can get onto something else.
Well, he's a curious hero. He is has a bad leg. He's not in charge really of much. He's a valet, and yet they continually have to make him heroic, because that's our feeling for him. We think of him as a strong character who's going to stand up for things against the grain. So he's constantly has to be doing that. We can't just have him in the house dressing Lord Grantham. Mr. Carson isn't a heroic guy. He holds the house together for us, and we like that about him. He's a stable. He's always going to be there. He's going to stand up for a whole class of people. And but he's not. He doesn't need to do anything that great. All he needs to do is every once in a while, like, look darkly at one of the servants in the corner who's done something a little bit wrong that nobody else has noticed, and we're like, nice job, Carson. That's funny.
Well, now they're the period now where they had what's her name, the head of the housemaids, his counterpart.
Oh yeah, she has the
I can't remember her name, but I'm terrible with names. But she had that little cancer scare, and it turns
out it's not O'Brien.
No, but it turns out that he's, you know, obviously has feelings for her a little bit. You can kind of see that.
That's always been there, the slowest burning romance in the house.
Yeah, this whole kind of, you know.
It's the remains of the day.
Exactly. Right? I was going to say, it's remains of the day. It seems to be in every British upstairs, downstairs type of.
Well, you have to have it where there, where
there's
emotions
like simmering,
are. Yeah.
Yeah, what is it with the Brits back then? It's just, you know,
they loved
get
the simmer.
Busy already.
No, they loved it.
They love the simmer. But you know what? When you simmer that long, the consummations, you've got too high of hopes. I mean, it's like the honeymoon. You're elevating this way beyond.
And nobody has any practice, so they're extremely clumsy.
Yeah, exactly.
They don't even know what they're doing.
It's just, it's never.
It's like two bears in a tent. You know, it's going to look stupid. The tent's going to come down.
Yeah.
No one's going to leave with any food.
No, everybody's going to walk away disappointed in this one. And that's going to turn you off for the whole rest of the trip.
Right.
So
I'm turned
off.
You know. I don't know how that did it, but.
So if we can go back in time, we would tell the British, get busy early.
Keep your hard R's.
Keep your hard R's.
To maintain more, be more British than the Americans.
Right. Right.
Right?
Okay.
And also keep the servants in the castles.
And get Pink Floyd in the studio sooner.
Yeah.
And
let them do whatever they want.
Right.
And what other?
Forget Sid Barrett. You don't even need that. Just go right to Dark Side. That's what we're saying to you.
What do you think of the people that have the? Every once in a while, somebody will do that whole pull the Sid Barrett on me. You know, like, but I really love Sid Barrett.
No, you know what?
Why do they do that?
You know, I get the Arnold Lane thing, but you know, it was just kind of, I don't know. I mean,
Arnold Lane thing.
Maybe Arnold Lane.
Is that what it is?
Kind of very
that's
the spacey,
is that
single.
The, no, I know. But it's like
Sid Barrett days.
It's like the syndrome of people who say that they like Sid Barrett better is the Arnold Lane syndrome. I get it, the Arnold Lane.
No. When Gilmore got going,
it's pretty clear. It doesn't even make sense when people say that. But I feel like. This is true. Anytime anybody's told me they prefer Sid Barrett, I will go and listen to a bunch of Sid Barrett just to be like, because it's like the Seinfeld thing. I'm like, maybe I missed it.
Yeah.
I'm going to go listen. And it just sounds like weird, slightly fun, this strange 60s jangle.
And
rock.
Remember we were talking about how dated, talk about something that sounds like it's time. It just doesn't, there's no,
yeah,
it's so of its time.
Right.
You know, it's like, let's go back and listen to Sonny and Cher records or something. I mean, you know, that's just not, it's just not, it doesn't have any relevance to any of my existence.
Right.
It doesn't work for me.
But some people just want to be so cool.
Mm-hmm.
Just drives me nuts. They sit in the center, they pull their pants down so you can see the boxers, and they're sitting there going, Sid Barrett, man.
Now you're really mixing things.
Well, it all mixes together. It's all the same guy. what if Rick? What if it turned out it was all the same guy?
What if?
I don't know what that means, but sometimes I want to just be allowed to say things like that.
This is why we do this.
That's right.
We can say whatever we want.
It's a release.
Made the night a little brighter wherever he would go. The old lamplighter of long, long ago. His snowy hair was so much whiter beneath the candle glow, the old lamp lighted of long, long ago. You'd hear the patter of his feet as he came toddling down the street. His smile had a lonely heart, you see. If there were sweethearts in the park, he'd pass a lamp and leave it dark, remembering the days that used to be. For he recalls when dreams were new, he loved someone who loved him too, who walks with him alone in memory. He made the night a little brighter wherever he would go. The old lamp lighted of long, long ago. Now if you look up in the sky, you'll understand the reason why the little stars at night are all aglow. He turns them on when night is here. He turns them off when dawn is near. The little man we loved of long ago. He made the night a little brighter wherever he.